The other day I was flicking through the newspaper and I got to the classified section, and there's this section in the classifieds called the memorial section. And I want to encourage you to look at that every now and then, because I was looking at it the other day and there was these memorials that people had put in, those little ads, for this father of some young children who had died. And it was really sad to read what they were saying. And I guess to them it was important that other people understood the way they felt. Because they had all these hopes, they had all these dreams of this one they loved, and it had been taken away from them. And there was this agony in death, this agony that came with death that you could see with them. And I heard also of a retiree recently who'd spent all this time getting his big camper van, you know, not just the little combi van, but the big camper van type thing, getting it all ready, getting it all set up. And he had all these plans, and him and his wife were going to travel around and do all these things. And then he had a stroke, and then after that died. And there's a certain agony that comes with that, isn't it? Where his plans come to nothing, and there's the agony of death itself. But as we come to this part of Matthew's Gospel, we face the death of Jesus. And I guess we face not just the death of Jesus, but the challenge that that brings to all of the plans and the promises that he had been making. Jesus had been planning to bring salvation and forgiveness. He'd been planning to bring new life for people. And here we see him hanging on a cross. Well, let's have a look at this then from verse 45. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now the sixth hour is about noon, and the ninth hour is about 3 p.m. So that's the time we're looking at. We see here that darkness comes over the land. Now, it could be a sign of God's judgment. Often darkness is a sign of God's judgment in the Bible. But whatever it's a sign of, it's certainly a sign of the presence of God at this event, isn't it? It's not that God's absent. God is present in this event. And Jesus cries out in the Hebrew language, my God, why have you forsaken me?" It's a quote from Psalm 22 where a man in that psalm laments at being forsaken by God. Now, what does it mean to be forsaken, to be abandoned? Well, I guess one example could be someone's agreed to pick you up from the union building. And so they said to you, "I'm going to pick you up at 3 o'clock. And so you're over there, you're waiting, and you're waiting. It's a quarter past 3. You're still waiting. It's half past 3. You're still waiting. It's a quarter to 4. And they've just abandoned you. They've just forgotten all about you. You've been forsaken. So that's one way that you can be abandoned, isn't it? Where someone just doesn't pick you up, or someone throws you out of the car or something. But of course, you can catch the bus home. You can hitch a lift. You can grab a taxi. You can still do something, can't you? That's not the type of abandon that Jesus is talking about here. The type of abandonment, the forsakenness that Jesus is having, is much more like when a mother gives birth to a child and for whatever sad reason can't have the child, and so she just goes and takes it somewhere and just leaves it. And that baby left on its own will die. Or it's like soldiers who are out in war, and because of some type of treachery, one soldier is abandoned by his other soldiers. And he's left out there on his own, and it's going to mean death. It's that type of abandonment. It's an abandonment that's going to lead to death, because to be forsaken by God is death. Let me just read to you from Ezekiel 39. Ezekiel 39, verse 23. It says, now this is God speaking about the nation of Israel under his judgment as they go into exile. But it still shows us what's happening with Jesus, I think, and you'll see that. It says, "The nations will know that the people of Israel went into exile for their sin, because they were unfaithful to me. So I hid my face from them and handed them over to their enemies. See, in the Old Testament, God with his people, there was a place when, and it's happening to Jesus now, as he carries the sin of the world, that God hides his face from him. That's what's happening to Jesus. And we have this anguish of Jesus. The anguish of why? My God, why have you forsaken me? Now, there's a real anguish to the why question, isn't there? I'm sure all of us at some stage have asked the why question. Maybe one of your parents has died. Maybe one of your brothers have died. Maybe one of your brothers or sisters is doing absolutely something stupid and destructive in their life. Maybe one of your relatives is doing that. And you can say to God, why? And there's a real anguish, isn't there? There's an agony as to why is God letting that happen. Now, we normally say this because we don't know why it's happening. We can't make sense of the situation. We know that God's in charge, but we don't know why this is happening. That's actually not what's happening with Jesus. It's actually worse for Jesus. See, when Jesus asks why, he knows that it is God's will for this to happen. We ask and say, why is it happening when we don't know why? Jesus says, why is it happening when he does know why? And there's a lot more anguish that he is suffering here. You see, he's really suffering the anguish of death. We see Jesus' forsakenness really highlighted in this event based around Elijah. Look at verses 47. When some of those standing there heard this, they said, he's calling Elijah. Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar and put it on a stick and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him. Now, when Jesus was calling out, Eli, Eli, you can see that sounds like Elijah. It's the same type of words. And the people who are hearing him are saying, oh, he's calling Elijah. Now, why is that important? Well, in the Old Testament, Elijah was a significant prophet. And there was a promise in the book of Malachi, and by the prophet Malachi, that Elijah would come and be involved in bringing God's kingdom in some way. And so here they are, they hear Jesus calling Elijah. And so they think, well, maybe Elijah's going to come and save him. So you can see why they're doing this. Now, in Western culture, the way that we do our movies is that, one of the common ways that we have our movies is that someone will get into a desperate situation and then somebody will come along and try to save them in some way and it won't work. And so then somebody else will come along and try to save them in another way and it won't work. And then their life is now at stake here. And it's not until you get to that life being completely at stake that the last effort, and you know it's the last effort, if this last effort doesn't come, they're going to die, the last one comes in at some grand finale and everyone feels relieved because this was the last chance. And really, Elijah here is seen as like the last chance. Just be quiet. And so they offer Jesus a drink because, see, Jesus is right on the edge of death. He's right on the edge of death. And they offer him this drink of sour wine, which is just like wine that's gone off, starting to turn into vinegar. But why are they giving it to him? It's not that they're actually being kind to him. It's that they want to revive him a little bit. They don't want him to die just yet because they want to see if Elijah's going to come. So it's actually quite callous them giving him this drink. But see, this is the last chance. Here is the righteous man, the sinless Son of God, on the cross, calling out, my God, why? And will Elijah come? What's going to happen at the very edge of death? Will God come and rescue him at the last moment? No, nothing happens. The last chance passes. Elijah doesn't come. God does nothing. And so we read in verse 50, and when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. You see, Jesus feels the full weight of death. That's what this account is showing us, isn't it? Jesus suffered the full anguish of death. Now, we need to know that as Christians, because we know that Jesus was raised from the dead, and I guess we might be tempted to think, well, he was going to get raised. His death wasn't really that bad because he knew he was going to get raised. But no, his death was the full anguish of death. Just because he was going to get raised, it didn't spare him at all from the death that he had to face. Now, is this the end? Has God actually abandoned this man? It certainly looks like it, doesn't it? Jesus made all these promises of bringing salvation, of bringing the new age, and here he is now dead. It seems like failure and defeat. And at the moment of his death, the very next verses in Matthew want to assure us that this is not the case. Look at verse 51. At that very moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split. The tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. Now, what's it saying there with the temple curtain tearing and with the dead being raised? It's saying that the new age, the age of God's kingdom, has begun. Come on in. It's saying that Jesus has died, but yet the new age has now come. You see, what was the temple curtain? Well, inside the temple was the place where God dwelt. That's what the temple in Jerusalem was about. It was the place where God's glory dwelt. But of course, no one could go in there because we're unclean in our sins. We're unholy before God. And so we were separated in this temple from God's presence by a thick curtain. The curtain in many ways was the heart of the temple. It was what separated the holy God from sinful people. But what happens to it? It's torn in two from the top to the bottom. That curtain that divided man from God, that separated humanity from God because of our sinfulness, that curtain is now torn down as the very heart of the old temple is being torn down and Jesus himself as the new temple is going to be rebuilt. You see, this is what the death of Jesus is achieving. As Jesus pays for our sins, he's cleaning us. He's paying for them so that we can stand clean and spotless before God. So that no matter what sin we've committed, we can now know that we can come into God's presence. Did you realise that with your prayers? That with your prayers, when you call out to God in Jesus' name, that spiritually you are in the presence of God. That's a great honour, isn't it? That the temple curtain has been ripped in half so that you can go into God's presence. It's a good reason to pray, isn't it? To make a regular time for our prayers and worship to God. See, the death of Jesus isn't a failure. The old temple is beginning to be torn apart. The new temple and the new forgiveness and salvation from God is coming. It also shows here all these dead being raised. It talks about the rock splitting and dead people being raised. And it's actually jumping ahead in time here to referring to after Jesus' resurrection. But just as Jesus had raised people from the dead like Lazarus, it seems that something like that had happened with several other dead people with Jesus' death and resurrection. So he raised people from the dead when he was alive, but even in his death, this happened to a fixed number of people as well. And it's really saying that the age of the resurrection, the new age of God, has now dawned. The age of God's eternal kingdom, where people will be raised and have the new life that God gives, that is now coming. And so what Matthew wants to assure us straight after reading about the death of Jesus is that Jesus' death is not a failure. But it is a success. It is bringing God's salvation and it's going to bring the resurrection and the new life of God. And I think he places this here and he goes ahead in time because he wants us to keep that in mind as we read everything else that comes after it. So let's see what comes after it because it really demonstrates the salvation and the power of God. Look at verse 54. When the centurion and those who were there guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." Many women were there watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. So here we have two groups of people, these centurions and these women who'd been following Jesus. And they're two really opposite groups, aren't they? The Roman centurions and guards, they're from the other nations. They're the Gentiles. These are the ones who have just mocked, tortured and killed Jesus. They are guilty of the death of Jesus. And the only reason they're standing there now is because they don't want anyone to interfere with this death sentence. What about the women? Well, these are Jewish women. These are the mothers of the disciples, or those that Jesus had ministered to. And they're innocent of Jesus' death. They've been following Jesus, and you notice there, they followed to care for his needs. How different is it, of the mother caring for the needs of Jesus compared to the soldier torturing and killing him? And the reason that they're standing around is because they love him to the end. And they just don't want to walk away no matter what. Two very different groups of people here. And they witnessed this earthquake. They witnessed this sign from God. And we see the power of God in this. As Jesus dies, the power of God is displayed in this physical way. The death of Jesus brings this power display of God where there's the earthquake. And so we read that those who had mocked and tortured and killed him now confess him as the Son of God. It's a pretty big change, isn't it? They confess him as the Son of God. They would have heard this phrase because while Jesus was being tormented and crucified and while he hung on the cross for many hours, people were saying, if you are the Son of God, if you are the Son of God. And so the soldiers were aware of what this meant. To whatever degree they fully understand it, I don't know, but they understood that that was the claim Jesus was making. And here we see that they're confessing the Son of God. Now, it's interesting because Matthew 16 really tells us what's involved in you confessing Jesus the Son of God. Let me just read to you. Matthew 16, verse 13. When Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do the people say the Son of Man is? He replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. But what about you, he asked, who do you say I am? Simon Peter answered, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, because this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. You see, to confess Jesus as the Messiah, as the Son of God, it requires God making him known to you. And so here we see this happening to these soldiers. We see them being granted salvation by God. But we see them being granted the faith to confess Jesus as Lord, as Son of God. And so they're actually given salvation. They're given forgiveness of sins. And so we see that the death of Jesus is powerful because these men who in many ways are the worst of sinners are granted salvation at the moment of Jesus' death. And the women, they witness this miraculous event. They witness what must have seemed impossible, that the worst of sinners confessed Jesus as Lord. It's sort of like the Apostle Paul, where he went around persecuting and killing Christians. But then God had mercy on him. The forgiveness of God, the forgiveness and the love of God came to that man, and the death of Jesus changed that man and saved that man. So the death of Jesus isn't weak. The death of Jesus is powerful and can save the worst of sinners like these guards or like the Apostle Paul. In fact, the death of Jesus can save you. It doesn't matter what sin you may be guilty of, and you may have guilt indeed. It doesn't matter what it is, Jesus can wash you clean. Jesus can give you a new life. Jesus can save you. And if you think that there's something holding you back, don't stay in that place. Don't stay thinking like that. Understand that the death of Jesus is powerful and that you need to get up out of your sin, receive that salvation and move on. Well, the next group that we see is this man, Joseph of Arimathea, as he does the burial of Jesus. Look at verse 57. As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. So here we see Jesus is dead, and this is now his burial. And we see this man, Joseph of Arimathea, in kindness serving Jesus. It was hard to be kind to Jesus while his crucifixion was on, but now they can, and so Joseph comes and he goes to Pilate and requests Jesus' body. And there's the humility of this rich man who could have sent his servants to go and do it, but he comes and does it himself. And he wraps Jesus in a clean cloth and he gives Jesus his own tomb. And then he secures the tomb so that Jesus' body can't be stolen or, you know, degraded in some way, but so that it's safe and it's respectably entombed. And again, the women witness this. The women are there witnessing this. But see, what else do they witness? Well, in Matthew 19, we read these words. Because we're particularly told that Joseph of Arimathea was a rich man. And that actually means something in Matthew's gospel. Let me just read to you from Matthew 19. I'll go from verse 23. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "I tell you the truth, it is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven." So it's hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. "Again, I tell you, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God." When the disciples heard this, they were greatly astonished and asked, "Who then can be saved?" He looked at them and said, "With man this is impossible, but with God all things are possible." You see, it's impossible for the rich to get into heaven. In fact, it's impossible for anyone, but particularly he focuses in on the rich. But what's impossible for man is possible with God. And here we see in the death of Jesus the impossible happening. The rich man following Jesus. The rich man prepared to confess Jesus even at the point of Jesus' death, when it seems Jesus has failed. You see, God was doing the impossible through Jesus' death. God's bringing about the impossible. That is, God is bringing about a new life for sinners like us, a type of life that we could never have on our own. And these women are witnessing this impossible, amazing thing. Let me tell you about Daniel Shayesty, a friend of mine. Daniel Shayesty grew up in Iran. And as over in Iran, he joined the Mujahideen, that is the Islamic Holy Warriors. And they went to war against the government in Iran. And Daniel's job was actually to kill people and set off bombs and to terrorize and to throw the country into confusion. And he did this. And he was one of the Mujahideen who helped to bring about the Islamic State of Iran. That's who Daniel was. Now he's an evangelist for Jesus. And he travels around pleading with Muslims to become Christians. What a remarkable change. Would you have ever thought that the guy bringing about the Islamic State would become a worldwide evangelist? Doesn't that just seem impossible? It really does. I'm sure you look at your friends, and when you're told by people like me and others that, you know, try to help them to become Christians, tell them the gospel so they can become Christians, you probably think, even though you may not say it, you probably just think, that's impossible. It's never going to happen. You know, the death of Jesus can bring about the impossible. The death of Jesus changed Daniel Shayesti in a way that people would think is impossible. The death of Jesus can change your friends. What we need to do is to ask and to keep asking, to seek and to keep seeking, to knock and to keep knocking, and to have that as a passion for our life, that we want to see the impossible happen, that we want God to do the impossible for us. That's what we need to be praying for, isn't it? If you feel it's impossible, then you're right, because it is for us, but it's not for God, because God is about giving new life through the death of Jesus. And this life, in Romans 8:38, it says that nothing can separate us from the love of God. Neither depth nor height, nothing at all can separate us from the love of God. So the death that Jesus dies, forsaken and abandoned, is the death now that you never need to have. Because when we die, we will know that God is with us, and that there is nothing, neither death nor anything, Paul says, that can separate us from the love of God. See, this is the new life that Jesus is bringing. This is the impossible things that the death of Jesus brings, so that now we can rest assured and we can have confidence that we will never be forsaken. Well, let's finish up with the last section here, verse 62. The next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. "Sir," they said, "we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise again.' So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people he has been raised from the dead. That last deception will be worse than the first." "Take a guard," Pilate answered. "Go, make the tomb as secure as you know how." So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard. Well, these people here, that they understood Jesus' promises. They heard what he was saying about being of rising from the dead. And they're going to do all they can to make sure that this stops. They've had enough of Jesus. They've had enough of his claims. They're going to make sure that Jesus stays in the grave. They don't want anything happening. And so they go to the governor and they bring about, that they get a legal decision made for them. They get a decision from the governor to try to stop this thing in its tracks. And, you know, there are many people who oppose God's plans like that even today. And they go to the governors that we have and they go out of their way so that Jesus is going to stay in the tomb, so that the power and the new life that Jesus is bringing is going to stay locked up. It's not going to go out. It's not going to be able to come anywhere else. It's going to stay there in the tomb. And they're going to do all they can to keep it in there. But of course, you can't oppose God's plans, can you? God's the one who splits open the rocks. He causes the sun to rise. Through Jesus, he did amazing things. Through Jesus, he changed people's lives. And as we're going to see next week, Jesus will in fact rise from the dead.